stop and listen. When will we all stop and see? When will we find what we've been missing? That the man in the moon must have found, 'cause he looks upon us with a frown. Truth we won't let shine, the light of truth we won't let shine. Tell me, has the world gone blind? The light of truth we won't let shine. As long as there's life, there's still a day. As long as there's life, there's still a day. And I know that we can find our way. For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
And welcome to Earthwatch on WBAI in New York, 99.5 megahertz FM and streaming at WBAI.org. My name is Robert Knight, and we have a prickly topic tonight, and that is the so-called tripwire real-time surveillance system that has burst into public awareness recently due to the publication of the secret memoranda and emails from Stratfor, the Strategic Forecasting Privatized Intelligence Organization. WikiLeaks obtained many cables or emails or communications, and in its global intelligence files, the most recent release, following, of course, the State Department cables, and before that, the collateral murder video of the war operations in Baghdad and Iraq and elsewhere. The current releases from Stratfor indicate that there is a highly complex and distributed system that has as its stated goal, according to the Abraxas Corporation, to do real-time monitoring of suspicious activity that is characterized as pre-operational planning for presumed terrorist activity, and to collate so-called suspicious activity reports. Suspicious activity reports are those things that you are reminded about every time you get on a subway with the loudspeaker messages and the posters and the advertisements that say, if you see something, say something. The suspicious activity reports going through that system are reported to be parsed and processed by this trapwire system of Abraxas. And whatever input goes into it is then cross-referenced with unknown methods of connecting one incident, one person, one face, one activity with other people, places, or things that are presumed by the system to be related, even if in different cities. It has aroused a great deal of civil libertarian concern, and the operation of it, the disclosure and such, have been topics of great passion and great debate. We engage or continue in that debate tonight with our guest, who is the author of a article on the website Storify about the Trapwire system. Ben Dornberg is the author of an article called Trapwire, the Truth Behind the Hype. And I'd like to welcome you to Earthwatch, sir.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
You are an independent journalist and a senior at Wesleyan University.
That is correct.
Well, I've given a rough description of what this system is. There are other elements to the story, including the assertion that many of the people in the officers and coordination of the Abraxas Corporation that came forward with this system are said to be related to or former members of the intelligence community. Now, in the WikiLeaked Stratfor emails, one of the things that Fred Burton, the honcho of that organization, said that Trapwire is a technology solution predicated upon behavior patterns in red zones to identify surveillance. It can connect the dots over time and distance. So let's begin with what your impression is of the Trapwire system.
Sure. Well, the goal, as you said, you know, as Fred Burton identified, the goal is that, let's say you have a suspect who's trying to surveil the New York subway, and then the next week goes to surveil the D.C. subway, you know, without being connected in any way, you know, there's no way to, as you said, connect the dots. So you wouldn't realize that there's this pattern of surveillance that's, you know, preparatory to a terrorist activity. So, you know, the goal is to connect the dots that were missed, you know, before 9/11. So Trapwire is, you know, it's definitely an advanced system. There's a lot of controversy over just how effective or how advanced it is. And that's largely because its exact capabilities are secret. You know, I tried to get in contact with some people to discuss the details, and I was told that it was classified and they're not able to discuss them. So it really leaves the public in the dark as to just where this system is installed and what it's capable of doing.
Well, we'll get into detail about what you have been able to find out or what you've published on the subject. But I'd like to just, clarify the discussion. Because when one says that a suspicious activity might involve a person surveilling the New York City subway and then surveilling the District of Columbia underground, that might be a suspicious activity, or it might be simply a tourist from New York who goes to see the cherry blossoms in Washington and takes the metro, the underground. So,
right.
So well, isn't there a religious presumption in identifying what are called suspicious behaviors?
Right. Well, that's exactly the problem. So my understanding from an interview with former official with the Toronto Transit Commission who'd seen the program in action is that a transit, you know, an operator of a Trapwire system, a surveillance camera that's attached to Trapwire, they'll tell it some parameters. So, for instance, look for someone who leaves a piece of luggage behind, or you could tell it, and I'm not saying that anyone has done this, you could tell it, look for people in baggy white clothing, or in a robe, or wearing a turban, or, you know, something of that nature.
Or baggy black skin.
For instance. And so what would happen is that when this Trapwire program that's attached to a surveillance camera detects whatever pattern you've told it to look for, it will zoom in on that area, and it'll bring that to the attention of a human, you know, a security guard or a police officer. And it will say, you know, take a look at this activity. And then the security guard or police officer will put a report into the system that says, you know, 6'4", black male of this description is, you know, engaging in this sort of activity. And then what Trapwire will do is cross-reference that with other reports from other cities that have been entered in and see, oh, well, there's a, you know, 6'2", you know, or a 6'3" black male who was also seen loitering in this area and, you know, in another city, and it'll try and match those up. But, you know, the danger is precisely what you've cited, which is that it's very difficult to determine what's a suspicious activity prior to a terrorist attack and what's, you know, a tourist taking pictures of the subway.
One of the phrases that's used in the description of Trapwire is pre-attack planning, which is something I would call scouting for a vacation. So,
yeah.
So the point that you've just made is a very astute, a very good one. In other words, if I'm getting the picture correctly here, the pre-programmed parameters to pull out of the data pool are not really predictive of crime or intent or conspiracy, but rather they're not predictive, but rather they are reflective of the bias of the operators.
Correct. Yes, it will. You know, at the end of the day, you know, and Trapwire actually has three components, but the component that's attached to a surveillance camera, it can only look for patterns that have either been programmed into it initially by Trapwire engineers, or assumptions and patterns that are put into it by the local operators. So, you know, Trapwire doesn't magically know what a terrorist looks like. That's someone with a set of beliefs about how terrorists operate, you know, tells it what to look for. So, you know, there's absolutely that human factor.
What have you been able to learn about the acuity and data reach of this system? I presume that it includes traffic video, police placement cameras, and sonic inputs, and subway magnetic card passes, and credit card movements, and cell phone locational tracking. What are the inputs to this system?
Sure. Well, there's a lot of uncertainty around exactly what the inputs are. And when the story initially broke, one of the issues that you had was that these Stratfor emails are not necessarily 100% accurate. So even though these are their own internal communications, for instance, this Fred Burton, who's a vice president of Stratfor, seems to, even in his private communications with his bosses, be in some cases just making things up, you know, that haven't been able to be verified. So as of now, it appears the inputs are primarily CCTV, you know, surveillance video cameras, both in transit systems and at you know, high risk, high value targets. So, for instance, in one of the emails, Fred Burton says that, some place like the Federal Mall in Washington, D.C., or maybe even the White House would have Trapwire attached to its cameras. And then the other main aspect is these systems like See Something, Say Something. So Trapwire, according to its own website, runs the New York and Las Vegas See Something, Say Something campaigns, and also other campaigns in D.C., L.A., and on military bases. So I always assumed that if you call in a See Something, Say Something report, that would go to the NYPD, and it would be kept within that arena. And that's actually not what happened. It's processed, the report. So if you call in and you say, you know, I saw a bag left here, that generates a suspicious activity report, just like you talked about. And obviously this raises an issue because you or I have no training on how to detect a terrorist as opposed to detecting a tourist. And so what happens is that those reports that are generated from a citizen calling in are go through Trapwire. And then if verified, they're sent to the local Department of Homeland Security Fusion Center, at which point they're put into a database that's accessible both by Department of Homeland Security fusion centers around the country, as well as the FBI's, it's called the eGuardian system. So your local report, when you call up that number that's on the subway, you know, is going to reach federal agencies all around the country. You know, there's a lot of speculation about Trapwire being tied in with things you mentioned, such as, you know, Metro swipe cards. And a lot of that has to do with confusion about Trapwire as a company. Trapwire's parent company was acquired by a company called Cubic that has its hands in a lot of different businesses, including transportation carts. But Trapwire was actually spun out as an independent company prior to that. So as of right now, Trapwire is essentially a standalone company that isn't integrated with all these other all these other businesses.
By that, Ben, you mean the Abraxas Corporation that operates or developed the Trapwire program?
Precisely. So Abraxas was acquired in 2007, I believe, or it officially, sorry, it was officially acquired in 2010 by Cubic. But in 2007, Abraxas Applications, which later became Trapwire, was spun out as an independent company. Now, the board of directors of Trapwire stayed essentially the same as the board of directors of Abraxas, the parent company. And so the people running Trapwire, you know, you mentioned the connections to the intelligence community. So what you have is the founder of Trapwire is a guy named Richard Helms, and he used to be the head of the CIA's European division. And the president and director of business development and director of operations for Trapwire are all ex-CIA operatives who spent at least 10 years working for the CIA, all in counterterrorism roles. So these are very, very experienced operatives, and the way that Abraxas was built, they actually used to recruit their employees in the CIA cafeteria. So these are, you know, this is not just a few employees with ties to the CIA. This is really the core of the company is, you know, dozens and potentially even hundreds of ex-CIA agents. Now that I'm talking here about Abraxas, the parent company, the employees of Trapwire, it's not really clear who exactly is working for Trapwire. It's very difficult to get clear information on.
Our guest is Ben Dorenberg. He is an independent journalist and a senior at Wesleyan University. What is your major, Ben?
I'm actually a sociology major. Wesleyan doesn't have a journalism major, but that's what I'm looking to do after I graduate.
Well, tell us a bit about how you came up with the piece on Storify.
Sure. So a security researcher named Justin Ferguson had access to the strat for emails that you talked about that were hacked by the Anonymous collective and submitted to WikiLeaks. So there were approximately, I believe, 5 million strat for emails that were hacked. And so far, only about 1,200 of them have been released because it takes an enormous amount of time to comb through all these emails and identify a coherent picture and to identify that something like Trapwire is noteworthy. So Justin Ferguson had discovered Trapwire and was connecting the pieces, and he, put on Twitter that people should be on the lookout for this coming release, and he also sent out some links to sort of preview versions of what was going to come out in the full release. So as soon as I saw these coming out, this seemed very significant to me. This idea that you had all of these surveillance systems that are, at least to some extent, tied together. For instance, in Las Vegas, the counterterrorism, the local police, and I believe it's several dozen resorts and casinos are all tied in together. So if there's a suspicious activity report coming from, MGM Grand or some casino, it'll show up at the Las Vegas Counterterrorism Center. So this seemed, you know, very significant to me. And so I began just digging through both the hacked emails as well as things that were publicly available and making a few phone calls. And, it is a situation where, the story is constantly evolving. There's always new information coming out, both in the regular press and then other people like me who may not work for the New York Times but are digging in and doing research. And so that's one of the advantages of something like Storify is that you can constantly be updating and pulling in the newest information. You're not stuck with, what the latest information was 10 hours ago, if that makes sense.
Well, Ben, irony of this moment leaves me almost breathless in that New York used to be a city where culturally there was the anonymity of a crowd. You could have your time out in the village. You could go to Brooklyn Heights. You could go all different kinds of places and have your privacy, even though surrounded by millions of people. And now, New York City has become a place where there are no secrets, and even worse, it is no longer true, literally, with Trapwire, that what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Don't you think that's...
Well, that's a fantastic way to work that phrase in, but I have to tell you, at least in the city of New York, Trapwire isn't even really what you should be worried about.
Oh, Lord.
Trapwire now in New York, for the most part, the new system is something called the Domain Awareness System. Have you familiar with that? That was just announced.
That was to be my next question. Domain Awareness System seems to be operating on a parallel thesis. And if I know government and the police class of this society that is becoming all the more powerful day by day, then of course the systems will eventually merge.
Right. Well, the NYPD actually claims that they don't use Trapwire at all.
That's a term of art. You know about that, right?
Yeah. So they...
Let me just say for the listeners that the transit system is very much a big proponent of the see something, say something, which goes through Trapwire. And it was a deceptive denial that the city made, saying that the New York Police Department does not directly subscribe to Trapwire. But the transit police system does. And so that's
right.
Pretty much all the same thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's my assumption as well. And there was actually part of a press release from Abraxas in the Washington Business Journal in 2007 says that it was underway, a test run was underway of Trapwire with, quote, a New York Police Department or, a police department in New York City. So, perhaps it is what you're saying that, it may just be the MTA, department and not the New York Police Department per se. But, I actually, from the details that have been released, this domain awareness system actually looks even more advanced than Trapwire. Trapwire, as far as I know, does not have the ability to scan license plates or determine if cars are emitting radiation, according to an article from Fast Company, those are capabilities that the domain awareness system has. Trapwire was programmed by programmers who work for Trapwire, and so I don't know their capabilities, but the domain awareness system is done with the help of Microsoft, which is obviously one of the largest and biggest high-tech companies in the world. So you're looking at a situation where, now I'm quoting from this Fast Company article, police are able to monitor thousands of CCTV cameras around the five boroughs, scan license plates, find out the kind of radiation cars are emitting, and extrapolate info on criminal and terrorism suspects from dozens of criminal databases, all in near real time. So the most, aggressive or the most, exaggerated guess of what Trapwire might be is pretty close to what the New York Police Department is publicly saying that the domain awareness system is.
Our guest is Ben Dorenberg. This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight, also heard on 5 O'Clock Shadow. And we're speaking with Ben Dorenberg, who is the author of the story Trapwire, the truth behind the hype, on the website Storify. And I'm going to do what Trapwire claims that it does and try and connect the dots. There is a tremendous ecologically upsetting edifice being built, or edifices being built, in the state of Utah for the National Security Agency, which I'm sure you are aware, is one of the biggest purveyors of monitoring electronic and signals intelligence in the United States. And Utah is going to bake from the excess heat from all the computers that are going to be put in there. Now, we've seen the evolution of storage hardware so that it now becomes relatively inexpensive to maintain great collections of even uninspected data. And I can't help but wonder, whether the data repository being built by the NSA might have any relation as a broker, a trafficker, an analyst of all of this information that is being collected by BAS and by Trapwire and similar systems. What do you think about that?
Sure. Well, I mean, that's one of the biggest concerns. And I'll get to the NSA aspect in a moment. But just to, you know, to back up what you're saying about the amount of data that's being collected here with the Domain Awareness System, or DAS, the expectation is that video is going to be held for 30 days and then deleted, quote, unless the NYPD chooses to archive it. So even if they chose never to archive anything, which seems rather unlikely, you know, you're talking about video from thousands of cameras being held for 30 days. That's an enormous. They're keeping information such as license plates for 5 years. So you are talking about just a massive amount of data that's being collected, and it does have to be stored somewhere. You know, whether the NSA has access to it is difficult to say. There was a whistleblower who came forward named William Binney earlier this year, and, you know, he said that essentially the, quote, the individual liberties preserved in the U.S. Constitution were no longer a consideration. So, you know, essentially, according to him, they're gathering data essentially indiscriminately on United States citizens. You know, it's almost impossible to confirm or verify the information. You know, the NSA is perhaps, you know, certainly up there as one of the most secretive agencies in the United States government. But it seems very clear that they're not building that, you know, that system out in Utah solely to, you know, look outwards towards other countries. They are collecting an enormous amount of data. What exactly they're doing with it, it's hard to say. But once the data is there, you know, you never know what someone will decide to do with it in 5 years. And, you know, it's important to recognize that if you have enough seemingly innocent data about someone, for instance, their cell phone locations over a period of time or where they've driven from the license plate monitors, you know, enough small pieces of seemingly meaningless data, you know, can add up to a very complete picture of somebody. So, you know, this definitely is something to be concerned about. And I'll also just say that the NYPD has said that this new DAS, Domain Awareness System, does not yet have facial recognition capabilities, but that's coming soon. So, you know, what's going to be done with that video, and will facial recognition be used on that? It's, you know, it's very hard to say.
Well, the Mr. Binney that you refer to from NSA actually was the keynote speaker of the HOPE Hackers Conference that is produced by our colleague here at WBAI, Emmanuel Goldstein. And we ourselves, on another show called 5 o'clock Shadow, have also spoken with Tom Drake, also from the agency, about exactly the same kind of concerns of overreaching intelligence investigations that trample the constitutional or legal or philosophical concept of privacy beyond any reasonable measure. Now, the use of this technology, you referred to facial recognition. There was quite a long period of time that facial recognition was vaporware, and it seems to me that one of the key requirements of having any kind of reliable algorithms, rather than simply selecting what the program thinks is the most likely out of a limited set of candidates, is to have cameras with higher and higher resolution. Because I suspect that most contemporary video cameras do not have the acuity or detail for a reliable face recognition system. In fact, the founder you refer to, Richard Helms, not the other legendary Richard Helms of CIA, Central Intelligence, the founder of Abraxas, Richard Hollis Helms, said that he sees the Trapwire system as collecting information in a way that is more accurate than facial recognition. So what do you make of that and other personal identification methods used in this?
Sure. Well, I think that my understanding so far is that when Trapwire says that they want to go beyond facial recognition, they're being a little bit disingenuous. What they're claiming is that by studying the behavior of a, quote, terrorist suspect and creating what they call a, quote, person print for somebody or a vehicle print of a vehicle, that this is just more effective than facial recognition. Now, whether that's actually true is very unclear. Again, one of the revelations from the Stratfor emails was that this Fred Burton and Stratfor were, Stratfor was receiving a finder's fee. If they got a new client for Trapwire, Stratfor got a cut. And so Stratfor had a big incentive to sort of exaggerate the capabilities of Trapwire's system. But part of one of the contracts that Stratfor did help Trapwire get was with the Department of Public Safety in Texas. And one of the aspects of the contract for the Texas installation was to upgrade the quality and resolution of the cameras. Now, not necessarily for facial recognition, but upgrading the cameras was part of this contract. But even beyond facial recognition, you have other things that you can be worried about. For instance, there's something called gait recognition, which is a capability to measure the way someone walks, and people have very distinctive walking patterns.
And we used to call that the gangster lean.
Yes. Well, I think you would probably get in trouble putting that into a government document. But exactly. So, now is that technology yet advanced enough to really put into use? That's hard to say. Maybe not. But, going forward, there are just endless ways that people can be identified, even if you don't have a picture of their face. For instance, people's movements via cell phones. There's a lot of lack of clarity over whether you even need a warrant to access that kind of information. These license plate, information about where people are driving. If they're keeping the data for up to 5 years, it's not very hard to find a pattern of where an individual goes. The number of one other thing to be aware of is that there are now incredibly powerful cameras. I believe they're called gigapixel cameras that can take pictures of an entire crowd at such a high resolution that you can zoom in a crowd of tens of thousands of people and look at one person's individual face and pick them out of a crowd. This is something I've seen pictures of. You remember those the hockey riots that happened in Canada?
Yeah.
There's a picture that's detailed enough that you can zoom in and see the face of anybody in that crowd in Vancouver.
There is also high-resolution photographic technology being developed for yet another piece of this picture that may or may not be plugged into domain awareness, or as John Poindexter called it, the total information awareness system, or going all the way back to the 1980s, Richard Conosciuto and a software package that was a notification system for prosecutors and police. And the idea of airborne, unpersoned aerial vehicles, drones, are being rushed into domestic surveillance service with rapid and perhaps reckless exceptions being granted by the Federal Aviation Administration. And one of the things that we learned recently there is that they are equipped with cameras of comparable high resolution. What do you make of the drone element in this increasingly complex system of surveillance?
Sure. Well, I think drones are actually a very underappreciated event on the civil liberties horizon. And the reason for that is, and I'll state up front that I'm not a lawyer, so I would encourage people to check these things out for themselves. But my understanding is that what seems to be the most relevant, you know, case law indicates that, you know, looking down from the sky on something that's, you know, other, even if it's, you couldn't observe it from the road, as long as you're not trespassing on someone's airspace, it's not an invasion of privacy to you know, look down with the camera. And this comes out of a case, I believe it's where a government agency did a flyover of a marijuana field and was able to determine that it was marijuana and was able to successfully prosecute someone for this. So you're looking at a situation where the FAA has been directed to come up with basically a system that will allow government agencies to deploy drones. And that's not just surveillance, but that's also maybe agricultural drones or, you know, all sorts of things. But, you know, you have essentially no regulation over this sector at all. And, you know, even if as of today it's impractical for a drone to spy on people because it's too big or it's too, you know, the cameras aren't effective enough, within 5 years, those limitations are going to be obsolete, and you already have drones that are the size of, you know, maybe large insects. I saw one the other day that it can function as a swarm, so it's a series of small insect-sized drones that can sort of assemble into a clump or spread out and go their separate ways. And so you're looking at just enormously advanced capabilities with very little legal oversight.
By swarm, you mean that they communicate peer-to-peer?
I mean, literally, they swarm as if, you know, as if it's a cloud of bees or flies or something.
And are they intercommunicating with local devices like themselves that autonomously follow their mission without constant instructions from a central command location?
So as of now, this is, you know, this isn't something that's active yet. This is just a proof of concept in a lab. I don't remember exactly which lab was working on this. But as of now, I think it's essentially remote controlled. But again, this is a situation where the technology, you know, the technology to have autonomous self-directing drones that communicate with each other and don't need to be controlled, you know, my understanding is that capability doesn't exist yet. But the chances that it might exist in 10 years are certainly very high. And, you know, this is an enormous, you know, growth area for the intelligence business community because obviously the types of wars that are being fought, you know, the amount of money that's left to be made from aircraft carriers is just not very high. That's not the type of conflict the U.S. is finding itself in. And so anything that can be used in an urban area or in, you know, sort of, you know, a nation-building circumstance, you know, that's where the attention and the, you know, defense budget dollars are headed, I think.
Our guest is Ben Dorenberg, and he is the author of Trapwire, The Truth Behind the Hype, that appears on the website Storify, storify.com. And why don't you give people the link so they can see your excellent thesis?
Sure. Well, you know, the best way to find it would just be to search Storify, and that's S-T-O-R-I-F-Y, and then Trapwire. So I would just search Storify Trapwire. Probably the easiest way to find it. But, yeah, no, it was very exciting. I got some excellent mentions from Wired and Salon and MSNBC. So it was, you know, very gratifying as an independent journalist who doesn't have the support of a big, you know, big newspaper or television station. It's, you know, very gratifying to see something that I do that gets appreciated. So it's,
I can certainly relate to that and very much appreciate the quality of your work. And there's a footnote I've meant to ask you about. Here in New York City and perhaps other towns as well, we see police cars that have cubes on the trunk, one on each side. They each seem to be pointing outward and forward at a 45-degree angle, and the face of this cube that is wired into some hardware in the trunk has what looks like it might be a Fresnel lens or something that may be used to emit light or infrared, and it has an aperture, which I presume contains a sensor. And I'm given to understand that these are the license plate reading devices. Do you have any detailed understanding of how they work?
There is actually a great piece in on the website Ars Technica today that talked about license plate readers, not specifically in the New York context, but sort of just a general view. There's actually a small town that has set up, you know, it has one road in and one road out, and they've just set up Tiburon, California. They've set up one camera going in and one camera going out, and so they have, you know, complete knowledge of every city that enters or leaves, that enters or leaves the city. So in terms of the New York Police Department specifically, I have to say I don't know what capabilities they have or how it is deployed in New York. And I have to say I'm surprised. I've actually never personally seen those cameras that you're talking about. You know, maybe I'm just not particularly observant, but...
I would argue that point.
Well, I've been to many Occupy Wall Street protests to cover those sorts of goings on, and I've seen probably more of the New York Police Department than I might prefer, but I haven't come across those yet. So, but I will definitely look into that after I get off the phone with you.
Well, we're speaking with Ben Dornberg, and Ben. In preparation for our discussion tonight, we've talked about the proliferation of technology and the police class. I guess maybe that's the sixth or seventh estate at this point in American cultural history. And Trapwire and the domain awareness system and total information awareness and Promise, that was the name of the police and prosecutorial notification system I was trying to remember before. And I got this for you to listen to and respond or react to in terms of the widening behavioral transformation of America. This is from the General Services Administration. The umbrella for the operation of federal facilities throughout the United States. And the idea that see something, say something is a New York-specific or city-specific operation would be to make a mistake because it is a federal program that is proliferating. And I think perhaps even hypnotically changing the traditional and noble attitude of freedom, independence, and privacy that used to be the hallmarks of the legendary American ethos. So this is from GSA. I'd like you to hear this. It's about a minute and a half or so, and tell me what you think. Here we go.
Employees at the more than 9,000 properties that GSA owns or leases around the country are now part of a nationwide anti-terrorism campaign.
And I'm pleased that in a number of diverse projects, we have been able to partner so effectively with the Department of Homeland Security to help our citizens' safety and to keep our nation secure.
The If You See Something, Say Something campaign is part of the Department of Homeland Security's efforts to raise security awareness at various venues across the U.S.
So over the past 5 months, we have expanded the If You See Something, Say Something campaign to transportation systems. You may have heard my voice on the D.C. Metro. We've expanded it to passenger rail, to mass transit, to general aviation. And we've also expanded it to sports arenas, to law enforcement fusion centers, to shopping malls. And as you know, yesterday we expanded it to Walmart, our nation's largest retailer.
On December 8th, the campaign was expanded again to include government buildings. Posters will be placed in all GSA buildings as a visual reminder for anyone to report suspicious activities.
Our See Something, Say Something posters are made specifically for occupants of these facilities. They display our emergency number, as you can see displayed, okay, so that they are clearly visible to everyone.
The If You See Something, Say Something campaign continues a long-standing relationship between GSA and the Federal Protective Service, which is charged with security in federal buildings.
We have continued to partner with them to make sure that federal buildings remain safe and secure for federal employees, yet welcoming to the thousands of visitors who come to federal buildings every day to get the services they need from their federal government.
Officials agree everyone shares a responsibility to keep these important facilities safe and secure. Judy Boysha, the General Services Administration.
There you are, Ben. What do you make of that?
Well, I have to say that if I was watching a science fiction film set in the near future, and that was that montage was the first 3 minutes of the movie, I would know what kind of movie I was watching, and I don't think it would be a very optimistic one. I think the idea that everyone in Walmart needs to be watching their fellow shoppers for signs of terrorism is just very worrisome, and it's just totally out of step with the proportion of the threat. I mean, you know, terrorism is a terrible thing, but as a comparison is often made, it just does not, statistically, it's just not something that the average person is ever going to come into contact with. I think I saw one estimate that you're as likely to be killed by the radiation from the airport scanner as you are by a terrorist. And, you know, it's just not, I don't think it's a good trade-off to sort of foster a culture of suspicion and constant, honestly, constant paranoia when there, you know, there just isn't the threat to justify it.
I have two reactions, and I think that was very insightful, what you just said. My two reactions are, when there's a package that someone has left behind, you get home and you say, damn, where are those groceries? And that is exactly why we have lost and found departments. And the paranoia causes subway stoppages, the behavioral brutality against people, the generation of enmity and distrust, and such an expensive, overreaching reaction for such an unlikely event. There comes a point when one has to realize that 0% risk is unachievable. But if there were an intelligent, ethical, and equitable application of investigative technologies, I'll tell you where they would be applied. I'll tell you what the high-value targets are, as they like to say. How about low-income, high-crime areas? Not that I'm asserting that this kind of intrusive spying should be done there. But if you're looking for crime, why not look in such a place? Or if you're really looking for crime, let's go and put these cameras inside the business offices on Wall Street.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what the NYPD would say to that is, well, you know, we are out in the low-income communities, and that's what stop and frisk is. I think that would, you know, probably be part of their response. And I think, I guess I'm just always hesitant. It's always tempting to say, well, why don't you just take this attitude and this, zealous approach to crime fighting and put it over there? But the honest truth is, I don't know where this sort of hostile approach would be effective. You know, I think you've seen with stop and frisk that putting it into, you know, low-income communities is certainly not productive.
No. Please let me be clear. I'm certainly only facetiously trying to point out what a predominantly white upper class with the privilege of police courtesies has.
Yes, well,
a very biased and antagonistic attitude about much of the spectrum of American society. And the stop and frisk is a manifestation of that. The arrogance of our mayor here, who purchased a third term is an indication of that. The stated purpose of it, which is to reduce firearms in New York City, has been meaningless. There are exactly or approximately the same number of gunshot incidents as there were before it began. So the purpose of a system is what it does, and clearly stop and frisk is a means of racial and economic control that also, and here we have to look at it, I think, Ben, as a data collection system in order to have prior knowledge of people of the underclass that can be used to impede their future success. It's a way of tagging and bagging young black people and Latino people. So I say that to say I'm not seriously saying that these egregious espionage systems should be put in low-income or high-crime areas. I'm just saying that there is a fallacy in the philosophy that creates such a system in the first place because the people operating it are bigoted.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to say, again, like I said, I went to many Occupy Wall Street protests to cover them, and it really was an eye-opener. You know, as a white male, you know, I was raised to you know, if I see a police officer when I need help, well, excellent, you know. And having seen even just a small taste of, you know, the other side of things, you know, it really is an awakening for me. And I saw, you know, some people were commenting on Twitter that, you know, for you know, privileged white people, it may be shocking to think that, you know, they're being surveilled. But for people of color, or, you know, homeless people, this is, you know, the idea that Big Brother is watching them is, you know, essentially a daily reality. And I think, you know, there is this perception that these security issues that we're talking about and, you know, internet freedom, you know, I think these are vital, vital issues. But there is a sense, I think, that these get disproportionate attention because they do affect, you know, white middle class people. And I think, you know, to some extent you saw that with the difference between in the reaction to the Aurora Dark Knight theater shooting incident and then what took place at the Sikh temple. You know, for better or for worse, and I would say for worse, you know, most people can't imagine, you know, being killed at a Sikh temple. And so it just didn't have that resonance with, what you might call middle America. But you know, a shooting in a movie theater, well, that could happen to me. And so, you know, that gets much more attention than the sort of, you know, daily murders that are happening in, you know, in poor areas around the country.
Our guest is Ben Dorenberg, and he is the author of the article Tripwire, The Truth Behind the Hype, that appears on Storify, and is also completing his major in sociology at Wesleyan University. And I must say that this conversation certainly gives me good indications about your aptitude and success in that field.
Well, thank you very much.
I would like to leave the floor open for you to summarize, to say what this means, and you know, to acknowledge your own work and tell us what we should be looking at and for.
Sure. Well, you know, I think the biggest revelation of the Trapwire documents was actually the response of the mainstream media and the people, you know, sort of experts in the field of surveillance. And the predominant reaction was that actually Trapwire really isn't that big, you know, of a news item, because we already knew that systems like this were out there, and this isn't even the most sophisticated one. That's a reaction that you saw in Slate, in the New York Times, you know, and to me that's more worrisome because, you know, as capabilities keep advancing, you know, there doesn't seem to be any countervailing pressure away from just increasing surveillance and increasing, you know, sort of building a security society. And so, you know, I think, you know, certainly for New Yorkers, I think the DAS, Domain Awareness System, is absolutely where you should be focusing your attention, because, you know, this is a system that publicly states that it has the capabilities people were worrying Trapwire secretly had. And so I think really this is probably the program that I would focus on. And then on the national level, you know, there's just so many to pick from, but I think, as you said, the NSA's spying activities are extremely worrisome. And then I think that the widespread deployment of drones that's going to be coming in the next few years is absolutely somewhere to watch. There are already drones that have been, assigned or purchased by local law enforcement agencies. And that's just going to, the number of agencies that have drones is just going to explode. So, unfortunately, there's a lot of interesting developments ahead.
Well, we're very grateful for your participation and keeping the heads up.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. It's really been delightful.
Well, good. We'll be doing more as the days come. And thank you once more. Ben Doerenberg, Doerenberg, correct? And check out his story, The Truth Behind the Hype About Trapwire, on StoryFind. And we'll be talking again soon, Ben. Thank you so much for being with us here on Earthwatch.
Fantastic. Yeah, have a great night.
All right. Thank you. I think we have a great night already in progress. This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight on WBA.
It don't worry me. It don't worry me. You may say I ain't free. It don't worry me. Don't worry me. It don't. Don't worry. Tax relief may never come. You don't worry me. Economy's depressed.
Come on, I need you. Come on.
My spirit's high.
Just
break him,
please.
You may say I ain't free. You don't worry me. Oh, you don't. Don't worry me. You may say, oh.
This is Earthwatch on WBAI. I'm Robert Knight, and we've been getting some phone calls. We'll take some on the air here. The phone number is 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900, and I suspect you might have many thoughts based on what Ben Dorenberg and I were talking about. We'll see. You're on the air. Hello.
Robert?
Yes. Hey.
Hi. Yeah, forgive me. I just caught the tail end, so I can only mostly obliquely reference. But what I did catch was like, oh, boy, you know, what can you say? There's nothing to add. He said so much. And anyway, you know how we have this phrase that's been part of the American pop culture parlance, and we almost see it, people have been conditioned to see it as prophetic wisdom, this notion of raising awareness, you know? And I'm thinking, well, where's Reverend Billy when you need him? Raising awareness, brothers and sisters, you know? And, you know, what is this vacuous notion of raising awareness? It's like we have to be reminded every 17 and a half minutes that cancer exists.
Actually, Reverend Billy was a day and a half ago at the anti-fracking protest at the pipeline coming into New York City. So he's out there.
I by no means was being dismissive of him. I was being laudatory of him. I was just using him as a vehicle to make my point.
Yeah.
But anyway, so to tie that in, I'm reminding myself to make a quick tie in here, to send a nasty little e-missive to the folks at Radio Shack or Radio Hut, whatever. Because I was there the other day buying some item, and the young lady there behind the counter asked me if I wanted to donate whatever, a dollar or two to cancer research, and I just bluntly said no. I didn't address her with any kind of nasty inflection. I just said no, and I because my reasoning to myself is, for some strange reason, I'm not enamored of the drivel that corporate America, vis-a-vis the pharmacy corporate industrial complex.
Well, actually, I'm reviewing the tape of that exchange that you had right now, even as we speak. So I'm going to have to let you go, and I'm going to refer this to higher authorities.
Well, okay, then.
Thank you for calling. All right. This is Earthwatch on WBAI, and you are on the air. Hello.
Hi, good morning, Robert.
Hey.
My impression, listening to the report on Trapwire, is that it seems like it's some sort of scam. I mean, that it is hype. Not, I'm saying that we don't live in a security state, but there was nothing that your guest seem to present with known capabilities. With that said, I think the following experience that I had on the Long Island Railroad, which does relate to the if you see something, say something. There are posters advertising all over Long Island Railroad cars, which I became overly familiar with for personal reasons. Not the transportation that I'd been using regularly as a New York resident, but that have a picture of a piece of luggage next to an open LIR car door, like a little wheelie thing. And it says, don't assume it was left by accident. The whole aspect of sort of the state of war that this would imply, it reminds me of the during World War II in factories and elsewhere, they had posters, loose lips sink ships. And so there was this whole paranoid ethos back then. And I think you're correct on one level about this being one of the main effects of these campaigns is promoting a mental attitude in the citizenry. But I want to go further. I on the Long Island Railroad, there are peak and off-peak times. And if you come on board, say, during peak, with an off-peak ticket, you can bump up your ticket to the more expensive peak ticket. And I had the experience of trying to do this on one of my recent trips out to the Long Island. But when you're bumped up, you don't pay the exact difference. On the Long Island Railroad, you're asked to pay a rounded up figure. This seemed to me to be unfair. And I refused to do this with the conductor. And within a minute, there were two off-duty New York policemen who were in my face and flashed a badge and suggested that if I didn't pay this difference, and I said I was willing to pay, I said I was willing to pay the exact fare, and I had the exact change, and I also told the conductor that I could understand bumping up to some rounded dollar figure might make sense to the degree that conductors shouldn't have to make all kinds of change for people. But I had the exact change, and I was willing to pay that difference. But no, he insisted that I pay the rounded up excessive fare. And I don't know whether he knew that there were these two off-duty cops traveling back to town. My suspicion was he might have known who they were because in collecting tickets, they might have flashed.
Well, you know that's where New York City police live, on the Long Island
Railroad. Yeah, I understand that part, and that's a whole other cultural issue.
But you bring me to a point, though, that just as you have reflected off what we were discussing before, you, through that incident, remind me of the mercenary nature, and I do not mean money-seeking.
Right.
I mean Hessian-like. I mean poltroons. I mean
alien. The occupation by some kind of law enforcement foreign mercenary.
Yes, exactly. Alien military occupation, which is what happens with Stop and Frisk, which is what happens in so many neighborhoods.
Right. But I just would like to continue this story to the bitter end. They told me that if I didn't pay, the MTA police would be waiting for me at one of the hub stations. And so I said, do you have jurisdiction on breach of Long Island Railroad regulations and fare charges? And they said, no. But I said, but you are willing to somehow contact the MTA and actually enforce it, and bring those policemen to the station. And this and the amount that I was disputing was something like 75 cents. Okay, so the mercenaries, as you so nicely put it, were willing to engage at least two law enforcement agencies for the amount of 75 cents. Now, I just do want to add, there were other of my fellow travelers, my fellow citizens, in the car who watched these proceedings and said absolutely nothing. There was no one who watched my back to say, I think it's unfair that you're doing this as well. Eventually, I paid the requested amount. When I finally got off at Penn, a brother who had been pretending to listen to his iPod, tapped me on the back and said, I understand where you're coming from. But as far as actually standing up for these kinds of abuses, that doesn't happen. And I sort of will leave it at that. Though I will say this. A video from years ago, from some years ago, of, which of the D.C. airports, showed a woman with a baby carriage, and I think her, one of the TSA agents, wanted to examine her bottle of water. And this woman, who later turned out to be ex-law enforcement, I believe, actually possibly an ex-intelligence person, was stopped, and they called in an entire small platoon of other law enforcement persons. And this is a video shot from, you know, a ceiling surveillance camera. And out of hundreds of people who go by this incident, of a woman with a baby carriage being, addressed by a whole slew of law enforcement persons, there is not one of her fellow travelers who stops to see what is going on, whether one of their fellows is being abused, or any of it.
We are in a society of fear foretold.
Well, indeed. Though I would disagree with one aspect, one small note that you made, that there used to be an ethos in America of, sort of don't tread on me, and privacy, and so on. And to some degree, that's true. But the dark side of that has always been a certain xenophobic, aspect. And that is what is being played upon these days. And, of course, the entire character of this is directly out of Orwell's 1984.
I would love to continue. There are
right.
some other people, but this has been a very stimulating discussion.
Right, I appreciate being able to call in and have some airtime.
Yeah, you're quite welcome.
Thank
and,
you.
A terrible story, well told, to which my only response is that once upon a time it was said that the black or colored person has no rights, that a white man need dare respect.
Mm.
Black people and people of color have been pioneers like astronauts, because today it has been pluralized, that attitude among law, so-called law enforcement people. And the motto I will leave you with for now is that in this new Rome, there is respect neither for citizen, centurion, or slave. Thanks for calling.
All set.
All right. This is Earthwatch on WBAI. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hello. Yes, this is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight, and you're on the air.
That was brilliant. Oh, you're a great moderator. You let that, it's so interesting to listening to the perspective that you're bringing on with your show and having the caller come in and present the other perspective and speak with such arrogance, and you let him just actually express himself. Again, this show's great because it gives me another perspective besides the one I'm usually hearing myself.
Well, thank you very much. You're obviously also a deep thinker. Oh. Okay. Well, thank you. You're on the air. This is Earthwatch.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey.
Is that me?
You're on the air.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Good.
Well, the gentleman who, just before this last call, he described how things have changed. So, and I agree with him, and to, in this country, and to acknowledge that, and this is the state of the state, and to approach these things in the same fashion from the past is insane. So the tactics have changed on that end, and the tactics of dealing with this have to change on this end to try to change it. Example, protesting, as you see, they're going to recognize people's faces and all of that. So you have to be creative, do things differently. And I would change the game and say, well, we're going to relate to people in a different way. We're not going to wake people up with protesting. We're going to have to enroll them. I, too, was on a bus and saw something similar happen. There was an elderly man sitting in the front of the bus, and he had a bag. He had a cane, and the bag was sticking out into the lane. But whose feet and legs aren't, and who's on their cell phone with their legs crossed? So the bus driver said, you got to excuse me, I'm walking, so I'm trying to, I'm a little out of breath. But
Yes, watch out for that car. You're about to hit the intersection, and we have you on GPS.
Oh, okay. He said, you got to move that to the back of the bus, but nobody moved to help this man. And by the time I was going to do it, he stormed out and walked out and cursed the bus driver. But I did tell the driver, listen, that was a little strong, and you should have helped them to the back of the bus.
Well, I look forward to future conversations in which we figure out some of these new methods that you say are needed. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome.
We want to squeeze in everybody who's in the process. A lot of people here tonight. And so try and make it a... Listen, we have... try and do it in a minute if you can. This is Earthwatch, and you're on the air.
How you doing?
Good.
Listen, you know, tonight... I was on the phone, and I kept hearing my voice echo. So I said, let me call Verizon. And I called Verizon, and I told him, I said, listen, is my phone tapping something? He goes, why is it echoing? He said, well, the guy says, well, I don't know. He says, well, let me test your phone. So he says, hang up. All right? So I hang up. And as a matter of fact, I got somebody to help me pretty quickly. At any rate, I hang up. He calls back, and he says, well, I don't know. We have to send somebody out to your house. I said, no. Because I think a lot of phones are tapped. And I'm just leery of the whole thing. I just think that the network even goes into your phone system, you know, your emails, everything. And I think that that person that they were going to send, might have been somebody just to come, maybe, possibly, to bug your house.
Okay, let me quickly reply. I hope you call back next week. There's hardly any need for the phone to be tapped in a way that we have historically known that, because each of the service providers, they used to be phone companies, and now they have branched out into many digital techniques.
I got a landline.
The telephone company operators and the internet communicators at the hubs, they have these several backbones and hubs, they call them, in the distribution of the internet and also telephone traffic. At each major hub or backbone, there is now a second carbon copy of the switcher, the computer that relays the signals to wherever they're going. The second computer is a duplicate for the National Security Agency.
So
there is nothing private on the internet.
Oh, there's nothing private.
I know you're talking about the phone, but the phone service now is almost completely digitized. So we're talking about traffic that moves in the same way.
Well, I'm sure, you know, but now the guy, you know, it was real quick to send somebody to my house. Now, if, you know, how you...
Well, we have insufficient data at this moment.
Right.
Okay. Well, thank you for calling.
Okay.
All right. I want to respect everybody who's got a call in, so we only have a few more minutes. So you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay.
Hey, I was just wondering, because I was paying attention to the massacre in Syria.
Oh, yeah, that.
And it's just interesting to me that on the one hand, we see the Russians and the Chinese backing the regime as they butcher everybody. And when I watch...
The Chinese and Russians are butchering?
Yeah, they're supporting that. They're giving them the weapons. The Russians
Who is?
Are giving them the weapons.
No, actually it's the United States that's doing
no,
that.
No. The United States is giving the opposition weapons. The United States is arming the opposition. But the regime is backed by Russia.
Well, when you say opposition, how can somebody coming from outside the country be legitimately described as opposition instead of invader?
All the kids who rose up are from the outside of the country?
The ones who have taken over Aleppo and the north and are now using surface-to-air missiles are extra-nationals. They come from the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. They come from Qatar. They come from Jihadi Sinai. They come from all throughout the region. And finally, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh,
hello.
Hi. Is this night watch?
Is this what?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Ah, you're on the radio, but we're out of time.
Oh, you're out of time.
Yeah, you got. If you could say it in three words, go.
Three words? I can't do it in three words. I can do it in 1 minute.
Not enough.
Okay, I'll have to do it.
Call me next week. Call me next week.
No problem.
Okay, we're taking epigrams at this point. 212-209-2900. Oh, actually, I shouldn't be announcing it because we're getting out of here. I want to be on time tonight. Jim Freund has a great guest in the person of Harlan Ellison in today's edition of Hour of the Wolf. You got an epigram?
Hello?
Hi. Do you have an epigram?
Robert Knight, this is the Greek goddess. How are you? I know it's going to sound really fruity, but I was just thinking of a lot of things when I was listening, and I thought of a very funny tale. That was a true tale. When I was in Brooklyn looking for a gypsy cab driving job, I went.
Wait! That's a story. I asked for an epigram.
Epigram? You have to define an epigram.
Something really short. Something as short as that.
Oh, I have to do a sound bite.
Not even a sound bite. A sound nibble.
Oh dear.
I love you, but
I flunked that.
Okay. Well, thank you. Call me next week.
Next week.
Yes.
Okay, I'll hold on till next week. Take care, hon.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Usually they like it to take a lot of time. And you're the last one. Hello?
Hello?
Yes. Your epigram?
Nightwatch?
Earthwatch, Robert Knight. You have 15 seconds. 15 seconds. Go.
Hello?
Yeah, you have 15 seconds before we gotta go.
I wanted to tell you, okay. I wanted to tell you about an incident that happened in West Long Branch, 4th of July.
Okay, that's a story. Don't have time. Gotta go. Okay. Jim Foran's coming up.
Okay.
All right.
All right, call back next week. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. Well, it has been a beautiful night tonight, and it's gonna stay that way. Jim Foran will be up in a minute and a half. With Hour of the Wolf. His guest is Harlan Ellison. And I really appreciate your wisdom and give great thanks to Dan Dorenberg for his insight on DAS and Trapwire and all of that. And you, the callers, the most brilliant audience in the world here at WDAI. Send me an email. Robert Knight, that's RKNIGHT at WBAI.org. And stay tuned and support the station.
people out there. This is comedian Barry Ribbs. I hope you tune in to 99.5 WBAI out of New York City. Listener-sponsored free speech radio.
I'd like to tell the crowd a little bit about myself. Sober now, by the grace of God, 3 hours. And ladies, I'm not going to have sex with any of you after the show. It's not that I don't want to. I'm just making a prediction.
FM WBAI, and we hope you come out March 28th to see a great comedy show.
And good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. This is a weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. So, this is another recorded edition for a few reasons, one of them being that I'm basically operating with a sore throat and doing, well, all kinds of personal stuff in my life. But overall, things ain't bad. And also, most of this program is pre-recorded because we did a very strange, unusual kind of a thing. We actually recorded the show practically as if it were a show this last weekend at the Lunacon Science Fiction Convention, which is held up in Rybrook, New York. And we had prearranged through volunteers or sacrifices or something like that, that Hildy Silverman, who's the editor of Space and Time magazine and a writer, and Charles E. Gannon, Chuck Gannon, would be the guests. And so we sat around a conference room, a small conference room, but good enough for radio, as we say, and recorded the show. There were a few people in there. We treated them as if they were phone callers. Whether or not they will be heard depends on time and the sound quality, which after recording this, well, I'll be listening to it and cutting stuff in or out. But before we get to any of that, well, there's the obligatory pitching. And this is the no-fooling, no-nonsense obligatory pitching. You may be aware that last night, Tuesday night, WBAI was off the air for several hours. No, it wasn't the transmitter this time. It was the phone company apparently trying to bill us for various things going back to October, which would be fine except for the fact that we didn't even have service in October. You see, there was this hurricane, Sandy. Well, That's neither here nor there. I don't know the details. I don't know who the good guys or the bad guys are. But whenever you're writing fiction or something and the phone company is involved, you know, think of the movie The President's Analyst, and you know who the bad guys are. One way or the other, it is very important and very, very necessary for WBAI to be on the air, to stay on the air. In all the years that I've worked here, we have never been this close to the precipice of going off the air, not just for a night or a week because of the hurricane or anything, but virtually for good. Between the transmitter and all these back funds, we seem to actually be doing well. We seem to be raising money for this emergency transmitter fund to make the... We have made the March 15th deadline. It looks like we will be able to make the March 31st deadline of $150,000, and then the April 1st deadline of another $50,000, which means that we have made $250,000 in a very short period of time, and that is thanks to you. That is thanks to people who are actually coming through. We are putting together benefits to try to make sure that we can raise some money off the air, and a great deal of the staff are pulling together to do this. This is one of those strange bedfellows kinds of things, except we're not really strange bedfellows, given the different types of politics that we have at WBAI. Nevertheless, what we all are is WBAI, and we all have to hang together, or stick together, I should say. We don't want to hang together, we want to stick together. We want to be broadcasting together, and we want to be broadcasting to you. And in order for us to continue to do that, we need to go through this emergency thing. We are, if we make that $250,000 by April 1st, that'll be the total, and we've done pretty well toward getting there. That's only half the battle, because we also have to pay transmitter rent, $50,000 every single month. The simple fact that we have saved a lot of money moving from 120 Wall Street up to Harlem to CCNY is a good thing, but in fact what it is saving us is about $25,000 to $28,000 a month, which on the one hand ain't chicken feed, but on the other hand, given all the expenses we have between payroll and $50,000 a month in the Empire State Building and so on and so forth, is, well, suffice it to say, we need to keep going. And for that, we have a special phone number. We have a call center number. We are outsourcing, pledges being taken, and we need you to call area code 516-620-3602. Again, 516-620-3602. The other thing you can do is you can go to the website, and the website is Give, G-I-V-E, then numeral 2, and WBAI.org. Give to WBAI.org. And I guess what that implies by that address is that you're not supposed to give once, but you're supposed to give twice. Give to WBAI.org. And once there, by the way, you have a couple of options. And one option is to just click on the upper left. You'll see something that says, you know, give to the transmitter fund. But over directly to the right of that is also a link that says, pledge in the name of your favorite show. Well, I know if it was me, my favorite show would have to be Hour of the Wolf because, well, what can one say? If the kind of programming that we do here in Hour of the Wolf, which involves literary science fiction and people reading to you, talking to you about it, and just all kinds of eclectic things. And we have some, assuming that there is a future, some exciting changes planned for the show in the future. More reviews, segments, things like that, which will involve two things. Number one, the continuance of WBAI, and number two, returning Hour of the Wolf to its 2 hours, or something like that. clearly, WBAI is going to change in one way or another. It's either for the worse or for the better. And when we say for the worse, that means that you will not be able to tune in 99.5 FM and hear us at all. We just won't be there. We are that close to being shut off between the transmitter. And we were shut off last night by Telco. And there are all kinds of things. On the other hand, we seem to be taking at least one half step backwards from that precipice. We seem to be doing well. But that means that we cannot let the momentum go down. We must keep the momentum going so that we will be out of the mire. And then looking into little things like buying a building for WBAI to move to. I cannot endorse this strongly enough. Our executive director, Summer Reese, has been talking about that. And of course, those who know are aware of the fact that my heart is sort of buried in the cornerstone of the church that we used to own, yes, own, on 62nd Street and 1st Avenue. How we lost that had a lot to do with, just for the sake of finger-pointing, with Pacifica and battles that we had with them in 1977. But it's a few years later, and right now Pacifica is our friend and also in as dire financial straits as we are. So, buying a building, it is. But first we have to get from here to there. First we have to survive in order to be able to make plans and point fingers and scream and yell at each other and smile at you and all that good stuff. So, again, please make a phone call right now. Area code 516-620-3602. Or get onto your web browser. I recommend a big browser, not a little mobile device, even a tablet. It's a little hard to read. I would go using a computer, a laptop, or a big screen, and go to give2wbai.org. So, I will actually introduce what was happening at the convention, at this event. Wasn't overly attended because, well, gee, sometimes I think that Lunacon and WBAI are run by the same people. There was not a lot of information given out on programming, and that had to do with people's illnesses and stuff like that. And we were Saturday morning at 11 a.m. doing an Hour of the Wolf at that time of day. Oh, that's an unusual and rarefied thing. But nevertheless, we did it, and I thought it came out pretty well, or pretty good, as the case may be, and I hope that you'll think so as well. So you are about to hear now, recorded from March 16th of the year 2013 at 11 a.m. at the Lunacon Science Fiction Convention, a pre-recorded episode in front of an audience of teeming half dozen of people. An episode of Hour of the Wolf. This is Lunacon. This is the New York Science Fiction Convention. And this is Hour of the Wolf after a fashion. My name is Jim Freund. And we have set up to have two guests. They are Hildy Silverman and Charles Gannon. So I figure for like 15 minutes, I will talk to one of you. Hi. So do either of you have a friend? Well, you've got a very full day.
I do have a full day.
And ladies first.
Oh.
Okay. So, and on Shabbos, yeah. Anyway. Hildy.
Yes.
I have admired to have you on the program even before you became owner, proprietor of Space and Time magazine.
Yeah, I think I go by publisher, because I own it and I publish it and I do all the things behind the scenes that get it produced every quarter.
Yeah.
And if there were such a thing, and there are such things as regular listeners to WBAI, they would know that Gordon Linsner birthed this magazine. How long ago?
About 46 years ago now, 1966, while in high school, yes.
Yeah, that's a year before I started doing this program, so.
Yes. Yeah, he's been
No. A year before I started volunteering at BAI.
Oh, okay.
Program began in 72.
Yeah, he was at it for a very long time.
Yeah.
First churning it out, I think, on mimeograph.
Of course.
The real basic, and went on from there, and along the way discovered a lot of really cool people and published their stories first.
Yeah, yeah. And also gave it really an interesting form, because it does the idea of poetry,
mm-hmm.
Which I don't recall other science fiction magazines, FNSF might have had a dirty limerick.
Yeah.
Or especially Asimov's. So Space and Time at this point is quarterly.
It is quarterly right now, yes. Unfortunately, I've been a little off schedule from time to time simply because of things in my own life. That's the downside of being very small press and being the single publisher, although I do have people who help me out with it and work for me.
Mm-hmm.
But it does, if my schedule gets fouled up, unfortunately, it has a ripple effect. But yes, quarterly. And our next issue is actually going to the printers this week and will be out for spring, which is not too far from now. So about 2 weeks it should be sent, going out to subscribers and out onto the shelves.
Who are the people that our listeners might have heard of who helped put this magazine together, he asked leadingly.
Good, and I'm so glad you asked that. I have fantastic people helping me out. My first readers, my associate editors, include Kathleen David, who is Peter David's wife, Alan Kistler, who's currently writing a compendium on Doctor Who. I mean, really great professionals. Gary Frank, who is a horror writer, successful horror writer. A lot of really great people are the associates. The main fiction editor is Gerard Horner, who is a fantastic writer in his own right. He's been doing this since Gordon's time. He's terrific.
Horner, yeah.
And the wonderful award-winning, Bram Stoker award-winning poet, Linda Addison, who is our poetry editor. You mentioned poetry earlier, who, again, has a fantastic eye for poetry, being a great poet herself. In fact, one of our poets, Geo Clark, is nominated for a Riesling this year.
Ah,
and we've had
the Riesling Award, a science fiction award for space poetry.
For genre poetry,
yeah.
Right? We've had other nominees, and we get some really good folks. And let's see, Diane Weinstein, who is a wonderful art director. We call her our art goddess because she's that awesome. She gets promoted to goddess. She worked for years for Weird Tales, about, I think, 18. And now she finds us our cover artist and our interior artist. And, again, a woman with a wonderful eye, and she's gotten me some really spectacular artists.
When did she start? Because there was a
goodness.
Point.
About when I mean, I...
Yeah, about when you took...
About
yeah.
when I did,
because,
so, yes,
because with all due respect for Gordon, I noticed a marked improvement in the cover art about the time you took over.
She's been wonderful, and a lot of the attention we got when we restyled the magazine after I took over was because of the artwork that she secured, and also the layout done by Kate Freeman. Kate Freeman handles my layout. She changed the interiors for me. She added some nice elements. She really kicked it up a notch, actually about five notches. So I'm very pleased. I'm very lucky with everyone I work with who helps me out on this.
Let's